All right, good afternoon. Welcome to the last section, I believe, of our lecturing marathon today. I bet you'll all be relieved. So I'm the first presenter in the group of three, our triad, on anthropogenic landscapes. I'm the ecologist of the group, so you're going to get the ecologist perspective first, followed by our anthropologist and our designer in order. We didn't end up integrating completely, which I think you'll find is one of the interesting parts, actually, of our seminar. And we've actually agreed that during the process of giving this presentation, we are going to question each other. So they're sitting there with the opportunity to interrupt me at any time to ask a question. So as an ecologist, and I think most of you are also familiar with this concept of the biosphere, that we basically have a natural pattern of tropical rainforests, deserts, grasslands around the world that's mostly defined by the long-term stable natural patterns of climate. That's the way to organize our thinking about life on Earth. And that evokes, I think for many of us, I know it does for me, when I ask myself quickly, what's the biosphere? I imagine tropical rainforests, wild forests somewhere, absorbing carbon dioxide and producing oxygen. But I think we're all here to discuss something different that has reshaped the planet. The Anthropocene is just one of many metaphors, global change. There's plenty of metaphors for humans changing everything. But in particular, we're talking about humans changing the Earth system. So in order to look at the ecology reshaped by humanity, I've presented another view that we need an anthropogenic biome, a human biosphere within which to structure our understanding of how humans have transformed ecology into new forms. And I'm going to use this lens of anthropogenic biomes or anthromes to look at the focus of our seminar, which is the anthropogenic landscape, the landscape created and sustained by humans, and of course also the landscapes that have sustained us. So one thing we still have left, we still have some wildlands left. We still have some places without people, some places without use of land directly. And those are mostly places where people haven't been so interested in using the land because it's not very productive, too cold and dry. And that's actually, if you want to think about wildlands, there are wild forests out there, but they're actually pretty rare compared to these less productive types of wildlands. We've also converted huge amounts of landscapes without converting them completely, without using them completely, and we call these semi-natural anthromes. Rangelands are very extensive around the world and are the areas that are used primarily for basically grazing and pasturing livestock, and they're very extensive but not so productive. And then one more familiar, I think, to everyone is the idea, of course, we have lots of croplands out there. We wouldn't be here without croplands, right? Agriculture is serving you three times a day. And when we think about crops, it's very easy to think about that as just one thing out there. There's just crops out there. But in fact, crops are intermingled with landscapes everywhere. And this is actually the most common, more densely populated anthrome is the rain-fed mosaic. And I'll talk a little more about the idea of mosaics and landscapes. This idea that crops are inserted within other types of land use. It's a multifunctional landscape. Villages, one of my specialties, is studying densely populated agricultural systems, many of which have persisted for very long periods of time. And of course, then we have urban or dense settlements. We often like to think of urban areas in the world as being these kind of modern, high-rise kind of conditions like the center of Berlin. But in fact, the most common form, the most extensive form of urban settlement is some kind of modest-sized city in a third world country that you've never heard of. That's most of the urban area of the world. So we've transformed the planet, and from my ecological point of view, and I would say my ecological point of view, not every ecologist's point of view, right? I can't represent ecological science. It's just my view within ecological science. We've used a certain amount of Earth's land, and we have directly in use about 40% of Earth's ice-free land surface for various forms of agriculture and settlements. We have about a quarter that we have not ever used and we have not settled, about a quarter left wild. And then we have this new category in between, the novel ecosystem. These are ecosystems that are not directly in use today. They might have been used at some time in the past or not, but they are embedded within this more used landscape. And in that way, they have become transformed. You have this mixture of parts of the landscape that resemble, or maybe even are, remnants of the biome that was there before. Say, in this region, it's probably some form of temperate forest. That was what was there before. And then we have areas that are directly settled and used. And this is a mosaic form. It's a landscape. And in landscape ecology, the simplest definition of a landscape is simply an area that is heterogeneous, that is composed of different things. There's variation within it. And that's our way of looking at the landscape from an ecological point of view. I happen to specialize, like I said, in more densely populated anthropogenic landscapes, and this is one of my study sites in Sichuan. And you can see it's a very complicated landscape. How do we study something that is a mixture of many things? And this may not seem to help much. It's quite complex looking, but having actually a view from above, the ability to understand the pattern of the landscape, not just from looking on the ground, and in fact, you can't see very much on the ground. This is actually the same landscape. Standing at the bottom of the hill, you have no idea what's going on around you. It's very complex, rugged, heterogeneous terrain. In fact, it's very hard to see even where the tops of the hills are versus the bottom. It's actually the bright green is the rice paddies at the bottom. In order to understand a landscape that is transformed, managed, and sustaining humans and sustained by humans, you need to actually work directly with humans. You can't just do ecology without people. So it's been very natural for me to be attracted to the concept of the Anthropocene because it connects people and Earth very tightly, which is what, of course, you see in say, a village landscape. So here is a part of a project where we're interpreting the landscape with the help of local people, making it possible for us to look at the ecology of this landscape and also how it's been changing. I also am a firm believer that you actually have to practice on the ground with people. If you really want to understand an agricultural ecology, you can't just do this by watching. You have to participate to some degree to really understand these things. And so that's one thing we're going to do in our case study. It's the one thing that we all agree on is you must be on site to understand a process of anthropogenic landscapes. The other point I want to make is about the idea that anthropogenic landscapes are not new. They are not a crisis. They are a perpetual part of what humans do. We have always transformed landscapes. As long as we've been a species, we continue to do so. If you look here, you can see we haven't all done it in the same way for the same length of time. The Earth has been transformed over a long period of time, thousands of years. This is just looking at agricultural land use. Of course, there's before agriculture. We even have earlier forms. This is actually a form of shifting cultivation, so this is agriculture. But even before this became agriculture, hunter-gatherers burned and opened up woodlands because it made them more productive for the people living there. So the idea that the people before the modern just were at home in an untransformed environment doesn't actually hold any evidence when you actually look at how Native people use the landscape. Transforming landscapes is something that we've always done. And we've done it more intensively over time. We've actually become more efficient, not because we want to. This is one of the hardest types of work you'll ever do in your life, transplanting rice. It's backbreaking work. And people don't really want to do this so much anymore. But for a long time, this was the only way to really get your daily rice, in this case. So people have voted with their feet now. The kinds of landscapes that we're seeing growing the fastest in many ways are the urbanizing landscapes. And here you see one that shocks, I think, a lot of people because it's so fast what's happening here. This place is this a design space or not? I don't know. But anyway, we have the idea of the city as an anthropogenic landscape. It's obviously very important. Most people live in the city now, and it's becoming more important over time. I would argue that it's part of a global transformation. It's not just going on in the city. But anyway, we've selected our site. I did not select this site. I have never been to the site. We will go to the site together for the first time this week. But I have had just a quick look, and I'm just going to look a little bit at the concept of how this landscape fits into a larger scheme of things, maybe how it fits into the biosphere or the Anthropocene. So here's our site that we're going to visit in Lichtenberg. We'll see a lot more about this. First thing to think about is, has this place always been the same? And you can see some dynamics here over time. These are just, you know, decadal effects. Believe it or not, there was actually 1942 aerial imagery. Surprisingly, it doesn't look all that different. There was a period somewhere in here where it was probably all destroyed because this was an industrial space, even during the war, it looks like, and those were probably blown up. But the bottom line is, it's still an urban place, an industrial space, even before 1950. If we take a step back, now we're going to start gaining perspective in space, not just in time. We can see the context of this site in the broader perspective of Berlin, and you can see that it's really pretty embedded in the urban matrix. This is not an exterior space or a frontier. It's a pretty urban space, even in 42. And this is the same place in 2014, just looking at where it fits into the kind of the urban fabric. But just looking at what I would call a pretty small scale, zooming out by a power of 10, we see the context of Berlin a little bit better, and we can see that it's embedded within an agricultural landscape. If you zoom out a bit, you'll see that it's not a city unto itself. It is part of a larger landscape at a regional scale, and that's a very small regional scale. There we're getting out a little bit further, another order of magnitude, and you can see Berlin is starting to appear like part of a larger agrarian landscape. And now I'm going back to the anthrome. Okay, this is the view of this space from the point of view of the anthropogenic biosphere. The yellow there are croplands, the dark red are true urban settlements, and the purple areas are what I'm calling villages. Some of them may actually be kind of mixed urban spaces, but some of them probably are remnant villages from the past. Okay, going out another order of magnitude, now we can see how the site fits into a broader context of Europe. And then finally, we can start to get, this isn't planetary, but it gives you some of a feel of what it looks like, Berlin and our site might look like from the point of view of a planetary perspective. And now I'm going back in time. So this is 1900, and you can see that things have changed substantially when we view this anthropogenic biosphere over time, that this landscape is embedded into. Here's 1700. You can see this area is mostly rangelands back then, and there's a lot of semi-natural lands. Agriculture hasn't spread over a large area in 1700 compared to today. And then finally, we have the view that we started with. There's just this natural space transformed by humans. I think you can see that these two things kind of don't go together. Somehow we have to find a way to view the biosphere not as, in a sense, its natural wild space that's disrupted by human activity, but rather as a place that's permanently transformed, that sustains us, that we need to sustain, but that is not natural in the proper sense. It's an anthropogenic landscape. And here, again, is the site from the perspective, maybe from a global perspective, and zooming back down to where we're going to be on Thursday, I'm hoping there's one other element we can take away here. So this is the zooming out in space, thinking globally about a local space, which I think is very important. I want us to think globally, because I think global transformation is an inherent part of the concept of the Anthropocene. The other inherent part of the Anthropocene, from my point of view, again, there's lots of different points of view, when we're talking about geologic time, and using the term Anthropocene implies that we're talking geologic time here. Geologic time is a perspective that we don't have. None of us are thinking geologically. We have to work very hard to imagine that we can think in timescales beyond the now, right? We're all very much thinking about, my God, will this lecture ever end? Can I get out and have my beer this afternoon? We're thinking about the now. It's just around just getting through the next few days. Then, of course, there's thinking a little bit broader. You know, what are we going to do over the next few years? That's pretty hard to get into that. But try thinking about the next few thousand years. And this is a chart that I stole from the Long Now Foundation. You can see just by inserting a zero before 2000, right? Just the idea that time is going to go on for tens of thousands of years. Time is going to continue with or without us. I want to bring that also as part of the Anthropocene, the perspective on a landscape. How has this place changed over the deep time, right? What does it really represent in this long time view, both in the past and in the future? These two are connected. And they're both important. The Anthropocene has taken a long time to come into being, and it's going to continue for a very long time. So how does that place us when we're thinking about landscapes? All right, thank you. And I think now we'll turn it over to Elena. Yeah, you didn't interrupt me once.
Right, so thank you. So what Ella's been doing is been bringing us back into in time, in and out in space, but eventually we had to land somewhere, and it's actually not true that we didn't agree on anything, because we've been processing various ideas, and eventually we decided that we would focus on the city. Of course, the world changes a lot according to the size of the window you're looking through. This has been said by Ursula Heiser, this has been shared as a thought in different phrasing by everyone here, I would guess. So the city is just an hypothesis. It's just a suggestion, of course. It's not the best, not the only way to look at a possible environment. We decide to choose a scale which contains bodies, contains, let me play the anthropologist here. I could play other parts, but okay, let's go for the anthropology now. So the city. The city is our provisional, temporary, common choice. Why the city? Why the city? Some very, very trivial answer. Population is immensely growing in the city. Of course, the world population is increasing overall, but the world population was 13%. City population was roughly the 13% at the beginning of 1900s, and it's been almost 50% of the total population today. So there's a sudden increase in population. At the same time, cities occupy a very small fraction of the total Earth surface, such as no higher than 6 or 7% of the total surface. On the other hand, there's the highest consumers of energy and resources, up to 70% of the general energy consumption occurs in the city, in the cities. So there's an imbalance between the relevance in size, in spatial extensions, density of population, and of course in consumes. So these are intriguing environments. Why the city again? The city is what's been called and shared again as a thought here. They are complex problem. The city is a multi-layered systems where some single look over a single disciplinary problem, of course, is not ever bringing us anywhere. So cities are the places where economy, sociality, urban planning, personal relationships, energy consumption all come together. They are entangled with each other. These multi-layered environments cannot be simplified. Whenever we try to simplify it, we just disrupt the complexity. Therefore, we come up with temporary, partial solutions. We end up not working. So the multiplicity of layers is something which has attracted us as a metaphor of a typical complex problem or weak problem in an anthropogenic context. So what happens in the city? Are cities the places where nature has been cancelled, has been put out on a side? Of course not. This is what's been also interesting for us. Cities are the place, are places, urban areas, are places where a very close interaction occurs between ecosystems and social systems. Okay, these two elements, these two actors onto the global scenario, ecosystems and social system, of course, coexist in most of the places, yeah? But in the cities, because of the structure I described before, they are forced to interact so deeply that their interdependence becomes inevitable, and it becomes potentially a factor of fragility. But let's go slower here. The nature... So the ecosystem and the social system coexisting, so insisting onto the very same spaces in metropolitan areas, reshape and recursively transform each other. So we cannot just take some example of natural study done in a forest and then, of course, shift it into an urban forest. We are going to be completely sidetracked. So such a coexistence is a complex problem. And as I said before, of course, it's a potential increase in vulnerability because, okay, again, here simplifying is something that we will really go through within our, during our seminar, but the decrease of space for development of the two actors, so the ecosystem and the social system, makes the entangled relationship very delicate, very fragile. Therefore, when one of the two elements, one of the two actors, gets out of equilibrium, the other also is dragged down. So such an equilibrium requires time to be formulated again, to be found again. And in city spaces, densely populated spaces, such a time is not there simply. So an action, inject another, and so, for example, such an image we might all recognize, this is Fukushima. It was typically natural event like an earthquake injecting a tsunami, another natural event, but the coastal villages were severely affected by floods, and here we turn into having some backlashes by the close interaction of dense human population along the coastlines. The floods injected fires, and as you all know, the fires in the nuclear power station generated the loss in radiation and stuff. So there was no time to recover from a mistake after the other. There was a possible consequence of the too close vicinity of these two systems. So what can be done about that? Of course, there's no solution, not even suggestion. There are hypothetical things. Oh, question early. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, you had to be more visible.
You guys' idea to do the interruption, so I'll throw it out there.
Please. I was just thinking you were.
So I just asked the question. You don't have to answer it. But just, are urban people the most vulnerable? I would question that.
I think going to have a slide about this. We have to decide about whose people and which urban areas are we talking about. Yeah. Anyway, let me answer just temporarily that urban people are an awful lot of people. So again, there we can decide who among the people living in urban areas is actually fragile. I mean, percentagely speaking, considering how many people live in urban areas, a lot of fragility should be there, could be there. Anyway, it's a good point. We'll go on that during the seminar. So what's been done so far to deal with such a complication? We observe some interesting example of engineered nature. This close interaction between these two actors I've been telling you about has come out with some interesting experiments, let's call it this way. Everybody recognizes the Central Park, this is Milan, this is dam systems around Amsterdam. But is engineering nature an answer to vulnerability? So if we agree that cities are vulnerable, is engineering nature a good strategy, an effective procedure to face vulnerability? And this is something that it's a bit tricky to introduce at this stage because it would require a longer time. So I'm going to go quickly about this, but let me just briefly say that it's been argued, for example, by Chakrabarty, that globalization and global warming are outcomes of the same origins, their consequences sharing the same origin, and they are now overlapping processes. So, these processes, such as overlap, can be better observed in medium and low-income countries and in low and medium cities and urban areas. So maybe this is partially an answer to your point earlier. So we cannot treat the world as one thing, of course. So rather than engineering nature, how would we define examples like this? This is Rio de Janeiro, this is Mumbai. Of course, these are, again, adaptation and resilience. These are examples of a proposition between living environment and ecosystems, but they look really different from the engineered nature examples I showed you before. So, what's going to happen to our conceptual tools? How are we going to investigate such a diverse spectrum of urban areas where resources availability is so different? In a very simple question, is engineering nature always affordable? Provided that it's an answer or it's a provisional solution for some cases, can we always afford it? Has it been always possible to refine the resources to engineer nature? Or shall we have a mosaic vision of the world? So we decided to look into city case studies because urban areas are places where all these questions come together. So let me be technical very quickly here. What happens on a biochemical and biophysical level into cities? So we have a shortening of the duration of the water cycles due to the modification of the morphology. We have significant changes of the microclimate due to local warming. We have, of course, weakened answers of the territory due to too fast processes of land conversion. We have modified biochemistries within city because of pollution agents. This would require a deepening, but we will see that these are all promises to be developed in the seminar. So these are all good reasons, we think, why to go and put a look into a metropolitan area, a district of a metropolitan area, and especially a place where all those factors can be observed together, that is to say, a formal industrial area, is good choice. So we selected Lichtenberg, which is a district here in Berlin, but we're going to have our third speaker, Arne is an expert in there, so he's going to just tell us everything about Lichtenberg industrial site. Let me just say the very last important thing, which is a bit of explanation why we're going to go on tour. So on the afternoon of our Thursday, the first state seminar, we're going to all together leave the HKW and move to Lichtenberg, which is less than an hour away. Hope you don't get lost in the way. Why do we decide to go there? Because as researchers, we think that every research endeavor starts from a personal experience. So we have to physically dive and sort of embody at least the first approach with a type of knowledge. So we have to be there, as has been said. But then our individual experience acquires meaning when it is projected onto a network of relationships, onto a reasoning network, into a collective thinking. So this is why hopefully the time of the going there, of the coming back, of the being on the site, it's doubling up, is speeding up our learning processes. Yes?
So I would like to add some notions why a city, so especially to your last part, why a city could be a good or well working out case study for the anthropocenic landscape. So this was one of the famous quotes of our German Chancellor Kohl after the reunification, said all this, let's say, landscapes from the new territories in the east will become blooming landscapes. And I will just point four or five little moments, little fragments, how the notion of landscape comes into the architectural production. And maybe one more note, architecture doesn't mean necessarily to design. Or on the other hand, if we talk about designing, it seems to me that the whole anthropocenic idea is really coming down like a top-down to a kind of scale where we're nearly impossible to keep on designing or we don't know how to act. So first some notions on the landscape thing. So clearly this Kohl quote was not meaning a kind of blooming landscape in terms of flowers or of agriculture, but more or less like the industrial landscape of the East. And we will need that later on for Lichtenberg. If we bring it down to architecture, just to give you a rough idea how we discuss about cities, one is the notion of Stadtlandschaft in German, which is the urban landscape. So this is one part of city planners, dealing with the urban landscape, describing the built and the green and the habitat within one plan. This is a Charoon plan from the 1950s. And if you look closer, you see like everything is drawn with the same line. It's just black and white lines, whether it's habitat, whether it's building, whether it's nature. The normal, let's say, the bigger part of the architects and city planner just use this model. It's just like it's either built or non-built. If we come to the green planning, let's say, or the landscape planning. This is a plan from 1910, Bigger Berlin, from Janssen. And we would normally say that's a very important part of the city making that we care about green areas. This is basically green areas. Do we have? So, and we will focus on this part here. So all this is like either parks, this one is woods. So it's all green, what you see marked with it, what's not white on the, in that representation. So in the same time, 1910, so this is a green plan, a very successful one. Going back, so this is a city, and just to show you, this is the Tiergarten. Going back, this is the Tiergarten, so we have a jump in scale. This is a Tiergarten, and if he overlaps it, we see, okay, was existing queen before, but then it comes into being that all these corridors, in the means of green planning, top-down green planning, destroy a lot of the existing habitat. So it's not this GNG that green is good any longer, but we're quite aware that even with the, in the name of green planning, of ecosystems, we go to destruct anyhow. So whether we plan on the black and white like figure, ground figure, or like building and non-building, it's the same with the green. It's not that the green is anyhow better in terms of top-down planning in cities than just to care about where buildings should be placed. And it's all embedded in the kind of, we don't only use the landscape term so often, it's also that we already have like shifted what you were calling the engineering nature, the engineered nature. We also have like several terms for it. So it's already like in 1540, when Bonfadio claimed this terza natura. So the first was the given one, the second one, let's say, was the agricultural one. The terza, in that term, we have an English translation, was somehow meant that parks within the cities or within city near landscapes, they related to kind of art-related quality, that they would call it a third nature. And then you can go on like fourth, fifth nature and industrial natures. And you see that this nature thing within a city planning is really not a kind of going back to what we all want to save. And maybe one more notion. In cities, we started quite early. So this is a plan from the Garden City, like 18th century. We really early started to divide into something that's green, garden, essential park, already third nature. We would have like the boulevard, which is like housing in habitat, and we would have like the industrial zone. And that's like you will find it in the 60s and the Siam notions, that we always think it like different places, that working and living and leisure time nature is some places that's not on the same surface, it's not on the same ground. On the other hand, and that makes it what I believe in, that the anthropocenic item could be very well implemented in the city scale. So that's where we all have the most experience about the built environment. So it's a kind of cultural experience that the building, the environment in cities really leads to another surrounding. So we experience there the most. We don't experience in the holidays on an island. We much more experience also in a kind of long, a kind of 1,000 year, 2,000 years term. We experience in cities the best. And that's leading to the point that we somehow, in the whole presentations, we had one notion when it was about a climate model. It was asked, how could we trace in the climate model a single human being? That was the only time I recognized today that a single human being, that let's say the experience of the single, was put into the discussion of the Anthropocene. And I would like to put in like a thinking model for the next, for the seminar on Thursday, Friday, a kind of quaternio. So one is clear, we have history, we have past and future, and we know that it's this kind of accelerating increase of anthropocenic fallout, let's call it like that. But on the other hand, we are in between, like on one hand, we have top-down, which is also the notion of the anthropocenic, how we call it, how we discuss it for the moment. It's like a top-down version of, let's say, knowledge is coming down to people and also to us. And then on the other hand, the bottom up, on the one hand, we have like structures, we have governance, we have representations like maps. And on the other, on the bottom up, I believe that we can't raise people to something that's how to contribute on the singular level. So bottom down to top down, which this would, in my field, would be like a clear top down development. even if it's occurring as something that's protecting, in this case, once again, the Tiergarten in Berlin. So coming to Lichtenberg, it became part of Berlin in this greater Berlin map we already saw. Now this is an image from 1970, around 1970, like huge housing blocks. This is the former VEB Elektrokohle Lichtenberg, which is like a huge factory for graphite, the biggest factory of graphite in East Germany. And maybe we keep in mind the size. This is around 50 meters. A lot of Vietnamese workers in that factory in that time. This is after the reunification, the first official visit of a foreign minister was Jack Lang visiting that site for a concert of Einstürzende Neubauten. You can't translate it maybe, but it's like collapsing new buildings. And maybe that's not by incident that the cultural minister was the first visitor and visiting that site for a concert of Einstürzende Neubauten. Then they began to dismantle it, and for sure they found all this kind of polluted earth. So now you will find the whole thing like this. It's all under a huge surface of concrete, as then rainwater can't wash out all the pollution. We have this remnants of the former production site, which reminds, if you put in a different narrative like the bounty model, or the Titanic one, a positive one would be like San Gimignano. We have first entrepreneurs, let's say, or this is a filmmaker. He started to make a mountain, as you can see, working hard. A kind of green mountain that's the first like new step from the cultural side, from cultural producers for a new habitat there. But what's even much more interesting, you have a really huge complex of this kind of, I think it's about nearly 80,000 square meters, which is, you have to count it yourself in the feet. Where a huge Vietnamese community is dealing. It's called the Dong Xuan Center. They have restaurants, and it's still an industrial area, so restaurants are forbidden. But you're allowed to have like places to eat and share with the other people working there, but it's all open for the public. They trade everything that you need in your whole life. They give all service from nail polishing, from massage, from travel studios, from agencies. So you really can get everything there, even if none of that is allowed. The only thing that would be allowed is storage or like a huge amount trade. That's only officially allowed purpose there. And so what could we find out there? One is like, for sure we could physically trace the layered and even covered parts of what of the anthropocenic past. So maybe we won't go for the deep time, but at least we would find all this, let's say, polluted parts. It's all there, we just have to dig a hole. And then the question is how to visualize this if it's, we normally tend to hide it, to cover it, and how to name it. There are no names around and just call it polluted earth. And on the other hand, which is from my point of view much more interesting, all this Vietnamese people, it's a quite huge community. They try to reclaim this zone for their habitat. So there are existing buildings to live in, but they're not allowed because it's industrial zone. But they do their best to do it anyhow. And maybe in this kind of practice they're putting up to adapt to the existing conditions, there is a kind of anthropocenic curriculum already embedded. Maybe we can find out about their practice, and I think it's much more interesting really to go for this kind of local research in that case. And if we have this question between like the bottom-up and the top down, or even if we're like here in Berlin, a kind of highly developed democracy. I just tell you one case. So like 2 months ago, we had a referendum on whether we should use the Tempelhof, the former Tempelhof airport, to build on, as Berlin is growing and we need new places to build houses, or that we should just leave it as a huge park. And the referendum, the people said, no, we don't want to have any longer this top-down decision-making of making housing there. But the only possibility was to say, no, there is no engagement of people in a kind of bottom-up structure to say something else than no, at least in this kind of decision-making we have in the political agenda in Germany right now. And that might be quite interesting point there to ask them, literally, what their anthropocentric experience is on that kind of really polluted landscape. Thanks.